Welcome to the Marketing Society podcast. I'm your host, Mike Pigott, editor at the Society. And today we're going to be talking about meaningful innovation. To join me to discuss this, I've got Dr. Nikki Morley, head of behavioral science and innovation expertise at the Insight division at Kantar, and Lou Ellerton, senior director at Kantar's consulting division. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Hello. So I guess with this chat, we're basically talking about, you guys wrote a piece for the Society website not too long ago called Getting to That Difficult Second Album, Rethinking Risk and Being Brave to Sustain Your Ability to Produce Meaningful Innovation. So I figured that's kind of a good place to start. I suppose with that, like, you know, why is the second album so difficult? If I was kind of going with like a musical analogy, you know, do you have that sort of enthusiasm and innovation first time round, and then it kind of does the edge get blunted, like as soon as you've sort of done that, when you give it a second go? What's everybody's thoughts?
I think it's a good question. I think one of the things that we found is that as with music, often people can reach success with the first album because they spot a natural gap in the market. And, you know, it may have taken them some time to spot that gap, but they have that real passion for it. They feel very strongly that it's what the market needs. And of course, it's often very difficult then to find another idea of the same degree of success within a kind of quite a fixed time frame, because unlike the first time around, when you might have spent 5 or 6 years looking for that first album, the second time around, your stakeholders or your shareholders want to see that within, you know, within 6 months, a year, 2 years, whatever it might be. So there's first of all the issue of finding that gap in the market and repeating that novelty and that nuance and freshness. And then, as you say, I think there's an expectation, there's a level of expectation that comes from your audience, and whether that audience is your financial investors or whether it's your customers, you know, they are looking for the same returns or greater the next time around. So anything that's going that would have been a perfectly good level of success first time around is never going to be good enough if your first time around was a blockbuster.
Yeah. I mean, do you think there's also a bit of a level of passion the first time around? Because people, you know, maybe get more excited about a new thing, and not necessarily the end user, but the people creating it as well. Whereas the second time around, you're sort of doing something quite similar. It's sort of similar, but slightly different. And I guess maybe that's harder to achieve because you're trying to give somebody something that they've sort of seen before, but something a bit different, hence the difficult second album, I guess. Is that kind of where the problem lies some of the time with sort of innovation?
I think it's because they've started to build a brand. They've started to establish some processes and ways of doing things. They've started to look at their numbers and their metrics. And in actual fact, they've sort of potentially lost sight of the fact that they need to be solving a sort of a consumer tension better than the competition. But they've got to do it in a way that's right for the brand. They've got to keep some of the essence of their distinctive assets. At the same time, they've got to be creative. So, you know, we talk about that being sort of meaningfully different. So it's got to be different enough. It's got to be better than competition. It's got to be meaningful to the consumer. It's got to solve a new tension. Otherwise, what you don't want to be doing is just innovating in a really small space, because then there's no incrementality, and it's all just cannibalized. It's all, you know, there's nothing different about it. Why should I buy this new thing over the thing you gave me before? So it's a really tricky task to try to get something that's incremental, that's meaningful, that's different enough to stay true to your brand.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, I guess there's the big sort of risk, right, of like going really far out there and being like, this is really, you know, like the concept album, essentially, if we're sticking to music. You're swinging for the fences, so it could be really great. And then if you get it right, or people respond to it, or whatever, then you're a genius, you know. But if you get it wrong, it's like, well, you know, they strayed too far from the formula, or what the hell are they doing? Nobody understands it. I guess you get the same in the brand world, right? They're like, well, just do this product or the service slightly different, with a twist, different color scheme or whatever. But that's such a small increment. Is it kind of finding like a medium size increment as opposed to like a large or a tiny one? Is that kind of where the sweet spot is?
Yeah, yeah. So what you don't want is like a little tiny renovation. You might try an improvement, don't get me wrong. You might need to improve it slightly, but yeah, the big opportunity comes when you do something that's differentiated enough to create a new audience, to create somebody else wants to buy it on top of your existing buyers. The people who buy it want to buy it more. So again, looking for that right opportunity space, it's a really fine balance. But we talk about that space being sort of very much that incremental space that, you know, we talk about new bringing in new users, premium up trading people. You know, what are you doing differently? Somebody's going to want to buy you again, or someone who didn't want to buy you before now wants to buy you.
I get a bit cynical sometimes because like it's when brands kind of like get really excited and they're like, guys, we've changed the color or we've like tweaked the tiniest thing. And everyone's like, so this is like a big song and dance. And it's like, well, that is a very, very small change and nobody really cares. Or, you know, it's now available in mint instead of lemon or whatever.
But it's interesting that because some people just say flavor innovations are really tricky. But in actual fact, if you're trying to get to a new occasion, say, you know, Gordon's is a really nice example, isn't it? You know, you've got Gordon's Pink and it attracted new people, you know, and then they've gone and Bailey's, you know, they got themselves out of Christmas by having strawberries and cream, which is their summer edition. So actually flavours done well are actually really good. But you're absolutely right that it's tempting just to bring out every flavour under the sun to really milk it. And people just then they're not there's no incremental benefit. You've wasted all that effort in innovating. And all that's happened is your other users probably swap to that one. And if it's not as profitable, then you really haven't done very well, have you?
Yeah. I guess there's a few out there. And like, I think last year, and I know they're a bit controversial for many, many reasons, but last year, our brand of the year, if I recall, was BrewDog, as voted for by society members. So I'm just going to say there was some sort of democratic process going on. But they are interesting in a way because they, when you talk about flavors, they have a whole bunch and, you know, they collaborate with a lot of people. But then I guess their sort of swing for the fences stuff is they've gone quite all out on climate change in sort of the last 12 months or so. And that's kind of been interesting to see. It's sort of like, I don't know, it's getting really behind a cause perhaps, but trying to do it, I guess, in their kind of punk way, or, you know, planting a forest or something like that. They're sort of shouting about a thing, but it doesn't feel like necessarily an incremental thing. It feels a little bit more significant. I don't know.
Absolutely. And I think they make some really bold moves. You know, we speak a lot to BrewDog. I think they're a really lovely example of actually it's all about meaningful innovation and sustainability is the gift that comes with it. They have sort of really got behind that cause. But actually, ultimately, it's all about making meaningfully different beers. And actually, they play the portfolio well. You know, they do a lot of test and learn. They have a lot of experimental brews. And actually, when they get to a big enough scale, then they launch them out into the supermarket. They really do. But as you say, they're a small brand. They can make bold moves. Actually, we find that smaller brands, it's much more easy to be sort of different in that sort of space. What they struggle with is perhaps being more meaningful. And actually, through their sustainability drive, through making really good beers, they've actually also enabled themselves to become meaningful.
I mean, the beer thing's quite interesting in a way, because I've gotten into the kind of non-alcoholic kind of craft beers in the last maybe 2 years, but they're really starting to pick up the non-alcoholic kind of market. But it does tend to be the slightly smaller brewers, you know, the maybe medium-sized ones rather than necessarily the big ones. I found it interesting. Guinness recently launched their kind of their non-alcoholic Guinness. So I'm very curious if the bigger players are starting to get into that space and how that's going to change things. Because I don't know about you guys, but I kind of see that as a potentially big thing. The same way, you know, the whole gluten-free kind of aisle in supermarkets is just getting bigger and bigger with more and more products.
Completely. And the converse is true, of course, as well, that we've seen the raging success of hard seltzer, which is kind of going the other way. So, you know, you can take the alcohol out of beer or you can put the alcohol into water. And and both of them are interesting because both of them have been driven by fundamentally passion projects. So by small brands, they have got heavily invested in a single idea. You know, and if you take the BrewDog analogy, everything they do is something they believe in strongly. And that's one of the key challenges that I think that the bigger brands and businesses face, is that to do this meaningful difference means finding something that you genuinely believe is going to offer something better. And it's very hard to do that with any authenticity if you know, if you genuinely know that you are launching this to fill a gap on the shelf with a flavor, you know, with a flavor tweak that frankly is because you're your boss is on your back that you haven't had enough new news. It's a lot easier to do when it's something of a make or break, and you know that every step forward is a huge landmark for you. For the Diageos and Unilevers of the world, it's much more about finding that incremental growth through really understanding their users, really understanding the kind of the human tensions, the insights at the heart of it, and what it is that's going to bring that meaning, that's going to connect that resonance. And it's interesting that both brands, like BrewDog, both brands have really pushed the boundaries on sustainability, on inclusion and diversity, on finding these ways to resonate with people's values as well as people's wallets, if you like.
You mentioned one word that I want to pick up on, which was boss, because I want to find out, because, and I think Dave Trott has talked about this and written about this in the past, about how you might be a really great innovator within, you're a small cog within the machine of like a big business, and your idea, just as it moves up and up the chain, gets more and more watered down because nobody wants to risk their job. Mm-hmm. And whether that's the same with, you know, agencies pitching to clients, et cetera, and you come up with a crazy idea and then it eventually gets watered down. So I'm just curious, like, how much of innovation comes from the top versus comes from the bottom? You know, if it comes from the bottom, how does it make it to the top? If it comes from the top, does anything actually get done? You know, what are the sort of challenges there with the whole, you know, red tape, whether it's a large or small organization?
I think one of the challenges, so innovations, I think the first thing to say is innovations can come from anywhere. And actually, innovation ideas can come from anybody, or should come from anybody who's close enough to a consumer to realize that their idea has got some legs to start with. I think the challenges are with getting ideas through is, now we always talk about this sort of learn, test and learn approach, this idea that in actual fact it's about building confidence and momentum. It's about learning about what you already know, learning a good, strong, fundamental understanding of the consumer and your strategy. And then doing a bit of testing and a bit of learning, that's what builds confidence in organizations. And actually, the faster organizations move, the better it is to take that approach. But actually, it's not always the approach that's taken. And I think increasingly, if you want to engage, you have to bring everybody with you, your markets, everyone with you along that journey. Really focus on building confidence and momentum, you know, data with some testing, with some insight, putting it all together and making the case and testing out things that, you know, your riskiest assumption, find it, do something about it. Now, I think it's gone are the days where, you know, it's impossible to get this sort of stuff through. And actually, the amount of data we collect, absolutely, we should be able to engage and build confidence in anybody at any place in the organization. But I completely sort of understand this idea of like, people just don't want to take a risk. But that's what the whole article we've written about was about, bravery. And it's about overcoming that risk by building that confidence and that momentum, so it doesn't feel like a risk anymore.
Yeah,
I think part of that is absolutely around the, you know, innovation can come from the bottom, can come from the middle, or can come from the top, but has to be sponsored by the top. Until you have that culture that allows you to encourage people to take risks and to know that they can take risks without their jobs being on the line, then inevitably you are never going to sponsor it. You're never going to create a culture of bravery, because bravery fundamentally comes from knowing there's a net underneath you to catch you. It's the job of the organization's culture to give you that net, to give you that sense of reassurance that then allows you to go out on a limb, that then allows you to do your concept album, knowing that it doesn't matter if not everyone succeeds, because the ones that do succeed will bring incremental gain that's significant enough to make it worthwhile.
Yeah. Do you think, I was just thinking, do you know, like how some organizations, they'll have like a, you know, a lab or a team that's like the crazy team that does all the stuff. I know that's for like ideas and innovation and stuff like that, but you also see it. I did a podcast talking about diversity once, and I was asking about diversity teams and, you know, the kind of working groups. And the answer that I got back was that, you know, these are only good to fix a problem because the organization doesn't like necessarily structurally have diversity through it. So they have to create a team to kind of remind everybody until the problem is in a better position. And I wonder if it's kind of the same with innovation. You know, you have the wacky team or whatever until it's more baked in throughout, you know, top to bottom throughout the process. I mean, is that something that you guys have found in your work?
It varies across different organisations, but yeah, there's usually, I want you to put the crazy team, the sort of the ones that have the licence to experiment, absolutely. And you're right, it's often the case that the main part of the business sort of struggles with that. But in actual fact, the more an organisation can enable all the culture we're talking about, the more they don't need that. But at the same time, I still like those teams. I still like the fact that they have, if they're governed properly, they have the license to really disrupt while the rest of your sort of business is focusing on this incremental stretch and getting out of their comfort zone enough. I think the challenge for me is some of the processes and the procedures. And it's whilst they're in place, it makes it difficult for them, the bulk of the business, to sort of, you know, stretch themselves and all the stuff we're talking about and be brave. But the organizations I see that do this well have both, and they both live happily, but they all have, as Lou says, increasingly that culture of being able to experiment, you know, across the business. And yeah, without it, you have to have this crazy team that sits in the corner trying to do things. But what I see is really difficult is they then struggle to implement it into the business because of the way they're organized. You know, they have to sell it back into people who are, you know, we said targeted, don't have the risk, you know, that safety net about them. So that it all has to live in harmony, really.
Mm. Is it a case of maybe taking the crazy team and sort of putting them on placements within other teams, you know, in the same way that agencies sometimes work in-house? So you're kind of closer to the people that are going to make the change. So you don't feel like this separate, you know, wacky person coming in with all the crazy ideas, but like, you know, actually the team that are involved in the day to day and all the business as usual stuff, they're like, oh great, it's the wacky lot have come in, and they're going to swan off. But how the hell are we going to actually implement this stuff? Whereas I guess if you're a bit closer to the sort of people on the ground, maybe that's a way of sort of getting innovation through a little bit more.
And we do see that a lot more, that, you know, the idea of the provocateur, the pirate inside culture, has been around for a while. I think the danger is that unless you're able to support that from within the ranks as well, that you end up with a culture that says that the only people who have permission to be creative, yep, to be experimental, to take risks, are these so-called wacky entrepreneurial types. And therefore the danger is that they become even more kind of divorced from the realities of the business, because everybody else says, oh God, you know, we're getting a provocateur. So it's about being very clear on what your restrictions and your risks are. And then, yes, absolutely, by all means, have a specialist unit who can address some of those, and whose whole remit is to approach innovation from an entirely different start point, an entirely different view. But don't prioritize that over driving the kind of incremental growth and stretch, absolutely, and creativity within the main business that you need. Because if you do, frankly, you know, you might as well just have a mergers and acquisitions policy that says you're going to buy every successful startup and, you know, and never try and innovate internally.
Yeah. It sounds a little bit like the sort of actor studio system, where like actors will be like, you know, one for me, one for you. So they'll do the big studio Hollywood movie, then they'll do the indie movie, and they'll sort of try and have that balance a little bit. I'm just using music and films and just going to throw those in. I want to move on to the meaningful bit, because I know in the article it was sort of talking about meaningful innovation. And I want to sort of find out if there are, you know, good ways to create meaning that you guys have seen. I mean, in the article you mentioned a few brands, Oatly, Flora, Halo Top, Carex Soaps. I just wondered what were they doing that sort of kind of fulfilled the meaningful bit of the innovation?
Well, they each focus, the reason we've highlighted them is they each focus on the one way in which, different ways in which you can be meaningful. So Oatly, they tapped into what we call the cultural zeitgeist. They connected to this growing, you know, we talked about gluten-free and sort of 0% earlier. They tapped into that growing dairy alternative sector, you know, and then you've got Flora, they capitalized on an emerging trend. Carex were really interesting because they really solved and met attention during the pandemic, because what they were able to do is actually to produce hand soap that's actually moisturizing. So they solved a real tension. So solving attention better than somebody else will drive meaning. You know, I love Halo Tops, always the one that my go-to example. You know, they make ice cream that you can eat and not put on weight. Ew, that is the epitome of new meaning, isn't it?
They are taking a
very crowded space, and they have really managed to sort of, you know, drive through a new benefit in a crowded market. And then finally, you know, you've got the likes, we talked about sort of Deliveroo, and, you know, those guys, you know, they access to consumers in the moment of their need. You know, they are bringing their products to consumers. You know, all of those, because you're right, meaning's quite intangible, but those are hopefully really nice examples of how you can actually drive meaning through innovation. You're doing something that a consumer needs. You're meeting their job to be done in a better or different way.
So one of the other things I wanted to explore a little bit was also the word bravery, because I know we're sort of drawing slightly near to our time. I just realized we're sort of rabbiting on about innovation and things, but which is good. But yeah, one of the things I wanted to delve into was bravery, and perhaps maybe related to the pandemic and how brands have been brave in different ways. And I was curious, like, are there other terms that we could use to potentially describe, you know, how brands have been in this moment? I mean, in your article, you talked about some of the phrases like the brands that are doing well, like they're facing forward, you know, never being satisfied, focusing their energies, you know, thinking brand first. I was trying to sort of sum those up with words like tenacious and progressive, and empathy comes up quite a lot, the empathetic leader and the empathetic brand. Maybe there isn't a single word other than bravery, but I just kind of curious what your thoughts are. Like, you know, is there an evolution of what brave means these days for brands?
It's a really good question. I think the problem or the issue has become that as with everything in marketing, we have a tendency to get bored with something once it's been successful for 6 months or so. So clearly, you know, agile was the last buzzword, and bravery is the next. And they are very difficult to unpack because they take on so much meaning around that. So all of those words you've mentioned, absolutely, you know, tenacity is incredibly important. Commitment, passion, empathy, all of those things are the things that can help to be brave. And indeed, some would say an element of naivety in bravery. But I think the at the heart of it is really understanding what it is that's going to enable you to reach that new growth. What is it in your particular organization that what are the factors that are holding you back, and what are the things that you're going to need to overcome with that? With some businesses, it's very much about empathy, whether that's a real understanding of human tensions and insights, or whether it's an understanding of what their customers need. With others, it's very much about taking a try, a test, learn, test, learn philosophy, and really being prepared to try and try again until you get it right. So bravery can have different forms, from the BrewDog style of bravery through to the through to something like Diageo, which has taken a much more, in some ways, a more sophisticated approach that's around providing all the reassurance that allows you, again, to have that safety net so it doesn't feel like a risk in the first place. But I think for me, one of the interesting words that we talk about is evolutionary. And there's often this sense of business being evolutionary versus revolutionary. And evolutionary becomes a bit of a poor cousin or a poor relation to that. And yet, if you look at somebody like Madonna or David Bowie, actually what we've seen is that they are continually evolving as well as potentially revolutionizing themselves. You know, they take the great bits and they keep those on, and they carry on with new iterations that are absolutely right for the time, for the space, for the people that they're targeting. So for me, that sense of evolution, perhaps evolution should no longer be a curse word when it comes to thinking about bravery, thinking about introducing new meaning to the category.
I think you also, in relation to Bowie in the article, you guys mentioned the phrase self-reflection, because, you know, Bowie's had like at least 5 personas through the years, but I didn't realize just how close a bunch of them were together in the 70s. I think he had 4 of them in the 70s, and then maybe arguably one in the sort of 2000s, late 2000s. So it was quite a sort of rapid reinvention. And I just wondered, like, are brands able to do anything like this? I'd really hesitate in some ways of comparing Bowie to a brand, but, you know, at least in terms of the sort of self-reflection and the reinvention side of things. We had an issue of a society publication, Empower, that we do. The theme was reinvention and recovery, because I wanted to explore how people are reinventing to recover, rather than the phrase, you know, build back better or anything like that. So I guess I just want to know, to what extent can brands sort of self-reflect and perhaps reinvent in quite a rapid way, despite their size, maybe?
I think for me, one of the key things is that Barry was the master of reinvention. But equally, there was a real degree of consistency. You know, he was always a fantastic musician. He was always he always had an incredibly lyrical turn of phrase, turn of voice, and so on. So, and in a sense, those are our brand consistents, if you were that, if you like that, that people knew when they were coming to Barry. They might not like a particular genre of music or a particular type on his album, or indeed a particular look that he was experimenting with at that moment, but they always knew that they could rely on him for some really great, powerful music. And that is at the heart of knowing what your brand is always going to give your customer, to give you as a consumer, is absolutely at the heart of it. Then, if you like, you can reskin it as much as you like, because you're always offering the, those that that key that sits at the heart. The way it's packaged up, absolutely, you know, be as revolutionary as you like, as long as you've got a clear view always in mind of what your heartland is.
So kind of keeping to the core, right? So keeping to the core of your brand, and then sort of, like you say, reinventing the skin, giving it a new avatar or something.
That's why I think it's so important when we talk about sort of brand first. I think that's exactly what we're saying. You know your brand and realize the important role that innovation can play to help you to reinvent yourself as such, but you must stay true to your brand. So we always recommend that sort of, you know, really thinking brand first around this to enable you to sort of have license to stretch. Where can your brand play happily? Where can your brand play in a space that no one else is playing better than anybody else? You know, that is the sort of almost the clues to your reinvention in the space you have to play in.
Mm. Yeah, I guess that's the trick, right? Is finding that little the little pockets of places to play.
And I guess that's why we talk about building from strong foundations, because if you really know what your brand's about, you really know what the trends are, you know where it, you know, and you've built those strong foundations, it's so much easier to do all of this. It's so much easier to be what we call meaningful different if you and reinvent yourself like Barry has, if you understand this well.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that like the Picasso thing as well? Basically, you got to know how to paint in a normal way before you start being really abstract. And so, I mean, that's we're pretty much coming to the end of our time, but it's been a wonderful discussion. I just wanted to find out whether you both had a kind of a final point or a final thing that you wanted to say. I don't really have a question, more just sort of leaving it open. If there's anything you just want to add following our chat to sort of leave the listeners with.
So, yeah, I think the word that's really been sort of stuck in my mind all year is this idea of learning, you know, really learning about your brand. You know, every time you put something into market, understand it, learn from it. It'll help you to know where to go. It'll help you to know how to be more meaningful, how to be more different, you know, and it's related to the word obsession as well. You know, it's like be obsessed with consumers. Yeah, we all hear this, be consumer centric, be obsessed. Learn about them, understand them, learn about your products in market. You know, so this word has really been sort of very much a feature, you know, taking yourself on a learning journey, I think.
Sounds good. Anything you want to add, Lee?
I think the idea of the continual journey is a really important one. And I think it's central to the idea of bravery, and it's central to the idea of meaning. That fundamentally, if you are if you try and put a stake in the ground and an anchor point that will stay the same for decades, or even frankly in the current climate for months, it's often difficult. But be prepared to realize that you're on a journey, your brand's on a journey, your culture's on a journey. And if you're going to sustain that level of meaning and that level of difference through bravery, you need to be able to flex. You need to be able to evolve what you're doing, how you're doing it, and be able to find the right points at which you're going to connect with people to create that meaningful difference.
You made me think of a ship when you were talking, because you know, you got your crew, you got your boat, but the sea is perhaps your I don't know, your people or society or culture, and it's kind of shifting, so it's more like the journey than necessarily the destination, perhaps. I don't know, would that be accurate, or am I way off?
Very zen, but also very true. The journey is the destination.
There we go. Absolutely. Sounds a good and terrible bit of advice from me to on which to end, but yeah, it just remains to say thank you so much to both of you for coming on the Marketing Society podcast.
My pleasure.
Thank you.